Welcome to Abide in Liberty, a podcast empowering patriots everywhere to re-enthrone faith, family, and freedom as the bedrock pillars of liberty in education, our communities, and our nation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back for yet another riveting episode of Abide in Liberty. Just as a reminder, we're currently working our way through the principles of freedom that were pretty commonly held and believed by almost all of the founding fathers as outlined in Cleon Skousen's book called The 5,000 Year Leap. The first one that we're going to talk about today is on the importance of a written constitution. Now, this may seem like a little bit of an obvious one to us today, because the only constitution that we know that we've grown up with that we understand is written. Of course, it's written down. How else would you do it, right? It seems pretty obvious. Seems like that kind of goes without saying. But for the majority of the history of the world, that was not necessarily how it went. Yes, there were kings that issued decrees, and those decrees would be written down. But as far as a formal set of rules that the government had to follow, whether that was a democratic government, which was the case in some examples in history, like in Greece, with the Anglo-Saxons and others, there wasn't necessarily, even in those times, a codified set of rules that those in power, whether it was many people in power through democracy or one person through a king or a queen, where they were bound by a written document that outlined the rules, the run rules for what they could and couldn't do. The Anglo-Saxons, these are the peoples of ancient England, were people that the founding fathers looked to as examples of self-governance. But even they, their common law was not written down. They kind of just trusted that everybody knew it. It was everybody's responsibility to understand how the government worked and what the laws were, and it was transmitted orally. It wasn't written down. Now, eventually, documents like the Magna Carta and the English Bill of Rights were written down, but even still, those were lists of rights that, in some cases, the common people kind of forced their leaders into signing and acknowledging that there's these things, these rights that Englishmen or English women had that the sovereign couldn't violate. But even so, those were a list of rights. It wasn't a list of rules for how to run the government. It wasn't a written constitution. So even though there were these elements of things that were written down throughout history, a complete guidebook, a complete set of rules that outlined what government could and couldn't do, including a list of Bill of Rights, was never really done before. So the fact that the founders implemented a written constitution, that was novel. That was new. That was an American invention, was to write it down and write it down in a way that it was transmissible and in a way that would make the leaders of that government more accountable to it. So again, I don't think I have to explain really why that's so important, because hopefully it's pretty obvious that if you want a set of rules that everybody knows about and everyone can follow it, it really helps to have it written down in a way that people can access it, people can read it, people can understand it, and people can hold their governments accountable to it because they know it and they have a way to transmit that information to others. The next principle that I'm going to talk about is the importance of limiting and defining the powers of government. So if you'll recall, and I know we've talked about this before, during the Constitutional Convention, this came just after the American Revolution, and the American Revolution was governed by the Articles of Confederation, and there were all kinds of problems with the Articles of Confederation. Number one being that the Continental Congress, these delegates that were tasked to oversee all the colonies and manage the war, were not given any authority whatsoever to enforce their decrees. So when they passed a law that required each state to come up with, say, 5% in taxes to help support the Continental Army, there was no way to enforce or make the states pay that tax. So this is where we get all these terrible stories that we hear from the American Revolution, where George Washington is just having to watch his soldiers starve and freeze to death because of lack of adequate supplies. It wasn't because they weren't to be had. It wasn't because there were no such supplies in America. It's because they were not able to purchase them because the Continental Congress couldn't enforce these laws and require the states to pay their fair share of the taxes. So what I bring this up again because it highlights how suspicious the founding fathers were of centralized power. They had had some experience with oppressive government. That was the whole reason why many of them and their forebears came to the Americas in the first place. They were escaping religious persecution that was imposed on them by strong, centralized, despotic government. So even though they knew they had to band together for the American Revolution to fight off Great Britain, they still shackled that Constitution, those Articles of Confederation, they still shackled the federal, kind of call it a government, so completely that it made them almost completely inept and impotent. They couldn't do anything really that a federal government or a centralized government should do. So that fear had not completely gone away by the time we get to the Constitutional Convention. What's different about the Constitutional Convention is they had the experience of the Revolutionary War to look back to and say, this didn't work. We didn't give the federal government enough authority to be actually effective, to be able to band together and help us defend ourselves. So they all knew that it was important to give a central government more authority than it had. But the big question, and the one that came up over and over again during the Constitutional Convention, and it came up over and over again in each state ratification convention, as each state considered whether they were going to adopt this constitution or not, that the question on everyone's mind was, have we given the federal government just enough authority to preserve our safety, to preserve our peace, and to make us a successful, strong nation without giving them too much where the central government could come and use that to tyrannize the states and the people of the United States of America? And one of the biggest things that they were worried about was if they gave the federal government too much power, would that government then take that power and use it to oppress not only the individuals, but also the states? And this is important to realize. The people were and are a central piece, a central, this is where the sovereign authority in the United States is from the people. But the states themselves were also viewed as political bodies, as sovereign political bodies that could act independent of a federal government. They could make some of their own decisions. The states could for the things that impacted the states. And so this is what one of the main reasons why the states demanded a Bill of Rights before agreeing to ratify the Constitution. Now, they agreed to ratify the Constitution with a promise that the first Congress would put together a Bill of Rights, which just says something about the integrity of people back then. Their word actually meant something, that we'll ratify, that they said, we'll ratify this Constitution so long as you pinky swear that you'll give us a Bill of Rights. And they did. They followed through on that promise. If only our politicians today could be trusted so far. Anyways, the Bill of Rights outlined all of these protections, that all of these things that the federal government couldn't touch, all of these rights that the federal government couldn't infringe upon, like the freedom of religion, the freedom of the press, freedom of speech, the right to bear arms, the right to not have the government quarter soldiers in your home, among others. And one of the most important ones, and one of the ones that we tend to overlook a lot, is the 10th Amendment, which says that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the state, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So this is the amendment, the Bill of Rights that says we've given the federal government this narrow scope of work that they can operate within. But anything outside of that, anything at all, big or small, is reserved or left to the states or to the people. If it's not listed as a responsibility for the federal government, then the states or the people are in charge. So right off the bat, from the beginning of our country, there was this tension between federal and state power. And this was intentional. The founding fathers set that up intentionally so that the states had authority to check the federal government. If the federal government started exceeding its mandate, started doing things that it wasn't supposed to, started exercising authority that wasn't specifically given to them in the Constitution. But by the same token, the federal government was given authority over the states to compel the states to not step into the sandbox of the federal government. If it's something that the federal government is supposed to do, then the states should stay out of it. So this tension, this is another area where the founding fathers separated the powers, right? We often talk about separation of powers being between the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch at the federal government level, but they built in an additional layer of separation of powers, and that was between the federal and the state and local levels. So with the three branches of government, you know, the legislative branch passes laws, the executive branch enforces those laws, and the judicial branch interprets the constitutionality of those laws. That's one way, that's kind of a horizontal separation of powers, if you will. The other separation of powers is vertical between the federal or national level and the local level, so that you have these competing interests and these competing authorities, and hopefully each would defend its own turf jealously and keep others from encroaching. So encroaching on their authority and on their power, and that would keep things in balance. That was the idea. And this separation of powers vertically between the federal government and the state governments is important to understand in order to make sense of how the founders originally set up for the House of Representatives and the Senate to be elected. So originally, the House of Representatives were to be selected by the people directly. And that's the way we do it today. The states are divided up into districts. People in each district run for office, and we, on election day, get to go vote and choose who we want to represent us in Congress. And that was the main way that the individual's interests would be protected at the federal level, because if the federal government started doing things that went against the interest of us, of the populace, we could fire them every 2 years. We have the chance to get rid of somebody that isn't doing what we want them to do and replace them with somebody else. Now, the senators, and this may seem a little strange to us today because this is not how it works today, but originally, the senators were elected by the legislatures of each state. So each state has their own kind of government, and a lot of it mirrors the federal government in some ways. We have a governor, some states have a lieutenant governor, and then each state has a legislature, and that could be, and each state does it a little bit differently, but think of it kind of like the legislature at the federal level. Here in Arizona, we have a House of Representatives and we have a Senate locally in Arizona that have nothing to do. They never go to Washington, D.C. and set laws there. That's all done in Phoenix at the state capitol here. The idea was that that legislature for Arizona, in this case, would elect the two senators that would go to Washington, D.C. and represent the states. So in that case, if the federal government began encroaching on the authority of the states, then the state legislatures had a mechanism that they could use to fire the senators and replace them, in this case, every 6 years. So that was one built-in protection that the founding fathers had that would allow states to push back on government trying to bring things that should be under state control under federal control. This was one of the main mechanisms that the founding fathers had set up to allow the states to enforce Amendment 10 that says if it's not a federal responsibility, it's left up to the states. Unfortunately, that was changed with the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. And that was passed to say that from now on, the senators are elected by the people directly, exactly like the House of Representatives. And actually, I do want to say, unfortunately, what this has done is it has left the states with only one recourse in if the federal government tries to impose its will or take state power to itself. And that's through the courts system, right? If the federal government does something that the states feel isn't right, that isn't an authority that the federal government has any responsibility over, then the state can initiate a lawsuit and it can go through the courts. And who knows how long that takes. But it's left the states completely dependent on the courts to enforce that appropriate balance of powers. And, you know, this is kind of unfortunate. This is a shift that our country has made in general in trusting the courts to be the sole arbiter of whether something is constitutional or not. I've talked about this before. The veto power of the president was intended to be a way for the president to turn down a law if he deemed it unconstitutional. It wasn't supposed to be, hey, I don't like this law, or this law goes against the tenets of my political party. It was supposed to be where the president looks at the law and says, not constitutional, I'm going to veto it. The judicial branch was supposed to be the last line of defense if all the other lines of defense have failed. In this case, with the states, the last line of defense is the only line of defense. And you can see how since that time, since the 17th Amendment, a lot of authority and a lot of power has shifted to Washington, D.C. that was left up to the states before. And that is a little bit of a scary thing. Now, you might be wondering, what's so bad about more authority flowing to Washington, D.C.? This division between federal and state power was kind of arbitrary. This is just what the founders picked. And maybe it's not so bad to have some of that authority move to Washington, D.C. Well, I'm glad you asked that question, and we will dive into that more on next week's episode.
Thank you for listening to Abide in Liberty. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and share this with friends and family. In the meantime, keep up with the show online at abideinliberty.com. Also, if you'd like to help our K-12 bless and educate more families, contact us by visiting libertyyouthacademy.org. Until next time, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, and be strong.